Oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States
Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-7150, Morton A. Bender et al. Versus Carolyn D. Jordan et al. Appellants, Independence Federal Savings Bank. Mr. Cook for appellants, Mr. Cuda for appellees.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Frederick D. Cook, Jr., counsel for the appellants in this matter. And excuse me, I'm not sure if your honors want me to address the questions that were addressed to us in your message, or if you would prefer I launch into my argument.
Well, I think our questions related to jurisdiction, so if you want to start there, that would be.
Sure, Your Honors. The question posed was whether the jurisdiction for this cross-claim was premised upon the original jurisdiction or the supplemental jurisdiction of the trial court. It's the position of appellants that, at best, the jurisdiction was supplemental. The jurisdiction was supplemental because the cross-claim in this matter was not brought or did not arise under federal law, notwithstanding the finding of the trial court. Where
do you think the trial court went wrong in its opinion?
Sure. I believe that the trial court's determination or decision, rather, that this matter arose under federal law because a provision of the Code of Federal Regulations authorized the Independence Federal Savings Bank to enter into an agreement with appellants caused the matter to arise under federal law. And I respectfully submit that that's incorrect. That's not what the body of case law, in my view, certainly says.
But in this case, it's a lot more than the regulation being the occasion of the contract, isn't it?
I'm not sure exactly what Your Honor means.
Well, I mean, I guess, how much state law is there in this case?
Okay, Your Honor. In this case, the cross-claim is a suit for breach of contract and unjust enrichment. Totally common law of the District of Columbia. Whether a contract arose, what the terms and conditions of that contract were, are not prescribed by the Code of Federal Regulations or federal law. It authorizes the entity to enter into the contract.
Is that true? Would the contract in its entirety be valid if it didn't comply with the regulation?
I believe that the...
Let's suppose it deliberately contradicted the regulation.
Sure.
Take the extreme case.
And I would suggest... Yeah, just Your Honor. And I would submit in that case, payment to the appellants would not be approved by the Office of Thrift Supervision, but that does not necessarily mean that the contract itself is void. Even where there is a decision by the disinterested board of directors or the directors to make a payment in reimbursement to a director, the Office of Thrift Supervision has to be notified, has to be given a 60-day notice. The Office of Thrift Supervision could say no. That doesn't mean the contract is invalid. It doesn't mean the contract hasn't satisfied the requirements of state common law. It just means that the Office of Thrift Supervision, once it finds out about it, says, I don't want you to pay it.
On your statement of it, the contract, although perhaps not invalid under state law, is still, in effect, a nullity, right? Because it can't be carried out except to the extent that it complies with federal law.
I believe that the Office of Thrift Supervision could say that, notwithstanding the fact that you didn't follow our requirements, notwithstanding the fact you didn't do this T or dot that I, we'll still authorize the payment if you do X and so.
But that's an interpretation of federal law, isn't it?
I don't believe
what OTS would be doing would be its interpretation of the regulation, and that would be valid to the extent that it was a permissible interpretation.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't know that it would be necessarily an interpretation of the regulation so much as it would be the OTS's policy implementation authority, which is not to interpret the regulation, but to simply say that we believe that in this case, payment is appropriate. And conversely, they could say, and we believe in this case, that payment is not appropriate, notwithstanding the fact that you meet all of the stated provisions of that provision of the Code of Federal Regulations.
Okay, I think I have your position.
Thank you, Your Honor. So we believe that this is a case that really is very simple. It's a case enforcing a contract, arguing that there's unjust enrichment. We believe that the provision of the Code of Federal Regulations requires, as does the Nicholson decision, requires that when there is not mandatory reimbursement, that reimbursement is permissive, that it is incumbent upon the entity, this case the board of IFSB, to make a good faith determination that permissive reimbursement will not be allowed. That's really critical in this case because this, as Your Honors know from reading the record, this has been a very vigorously contested case for years, lots of time and effort involved, lots of hard feelings. It's especially true in a case like this where the persons who acted pursuant to a decision by a majority of the board resigned from the board, and the new majority, loyal arguably to Mr. Bender, decides that reimbursement is not going to be had. There was not a decision made by disinterested members of the board of directors that we can point to.
You're finding this implied in the regulation.
I believe that it's...
I didn't see you citing state corporation law.
There is in the Allworth decision requires good faith and fair dealing in all contracts in District of Columbia, a matter of District of Columbia law. Further, in the Nicholson decision, which we cite, and the letter from the Office of Thrift Supervision, it says that the directors must act, or the decision of the directors must be made in good faith and based on the board's fiduciary obligations to all the parties involved, to include the institution, obviously. So there is an obligation that they act in good faith, that we believe they've not discharged in this case, that certainly you can't discern from a summary disposition of this case. That requires more than summary disposition will allow. And this matter, as again, Your Honors know, was resolved summarily. And our complaint is, on appeal, is that the plaintiffs in this case did not demonstrate that they were entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law. And as a consequence, there needs to be a more fulsome exploration of the facts and circumstances surrounding whether that obligation to act in good faith, whether that obligation to deal fairly was met.
Isn't the main function of the regulation, in fact, to protect the resources of the bank? Given that, isn't it hard to spin out of the total context a duty to for affirmative action to be taken to, first place, create this disinterested group of directors, then have them rule on the good faith of the directors who lost the litigation?
Sure. I don't see those as inconsistent, Your Honor. I think that Your Honor may well be correct that the overarching concern here is to make sure that the fiscal integrity of the institution is preserved, that monies that should be spent on certain things are spent on those and not on others. But that doesn't mean that board members can't act in willful disregard of their obligation to act in good faith. Now, if it turns out that I believe as a board member, a disinterested board member, that a former director ought to be reimbursed, but the cupboard is bare, then so be it. But that doesn't mean I don't have an obligation.
Taking it out of the cupboard makes the cupboard less full, right?
Well, no, Your Honor.
You don't want a rule that operates only at the moment the
no, Your Honor.
It's totally bare.
Absolutely. Maybe an imprecise hyperbolic statement. But if there are funds that do not threaten the fiscal integrity of the institution, then my obligation to act in good faith is not inconsistent with the interest of the institution. But if the institution's fiscal resources are inadequate, however you want to articulate it, describe it, then I can't get there from here. But that doesn't mean I don't have the burden to act in good faith. I don't see those two things as being inconsistent. This is important also because this case, in terms of supplemental jurisdiction piece, the claim for reimbursement could not have been made until the decision of the trial court was made with respect to the preliminary injunction matter. So there was a lack of justiciability for this claim when the main lawsuit was filed. But importantly, the underlying lawsuit was dismissed. It was dismissed as moot just as this counterclaim was this cross-claim was filed.
Is it just to get it more precisely, your argument is not merely that the board must act in good faith, but that the board must act. And once it must act in good faith. But apart from a general duty to act in good faith, it's not clear where you're finding a duty to act at all.
The two provisions of 12 CFR 54512, C1 and C2, one talks about mandatory, C1 about mandatory, and two talks about permissive. When there's no mandatory reimbursement, then you have necessity shift to permissive.
But that seems to kind of follow on what Judge Williams is saying, which is in the one case you do have an affirmative responsibility, but when it's permissive, you don't. So where is the requirement that the board act?
Well, I think if you look at the Nicholson case and look at the letter from the Office of Thrift Supervision that talks about the tasks that confront a board of directors in such a situation, I think from my perspective, that means that you logically move from subparagraph one to subparagraph two, that there's an affirmative responsibility to make that decision once you determine as a board member that there is no mandatory reimbursement. In the Nicholson decision, which is found at 1991 U.S. District Lexus 21143, I don't have another cite for it, Your Honor. I'm sorry about that. The letter from the regulations of the Office of Thrift Supervision say that give the interpretation that I'm referring to, that sort of logically move you from a finding that there is no mandatory reimbursement to a decision by the board next to see if there is permissive reimbursement.
Mr. Clark, I'm sorry, you have a question?
Can the bank, either under the regulations or the contract, give indemnification to someone who does not prevail in the litigation?
I believe that under subsection 2, that's possible.
Where?
I believe that...
Where does it say that?
In...
In other words, at the end of the day, I understand your timing arguments and who did what when and whether because they did it at a certain time indicates it could not have been in good faith. At the end of the day, is it even permissible under the contract or the regulations to afford indemnity to someone who has lost the litigation? I did not see how that was possible.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that in subparagraph small Roman numeral 2, final judgment in his or her favor other than on the merits, if a majority of the disinterested directors of the savings association determine that he or she was acting in good faith within the scope of his or her employment.
Final judgment in his merits, so that's not applicable.
Because it wasn't the final judgment in this case. The case was dismissed as moot.
talking about on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not talking about on the cross-claim.
Not in the cross-claim, no, Your Honor. Because arguably, from my perspective, the cross-claim shouldn't have been in front of the trial court because...
Well, let's assume the trial court did have jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Then what?
Then a final decision on the merits of the underlying claim would have been a necessary predicate, a necessary precondition.
To what? To jurisdiction or to the indemnification? I'm not... In other words, let's assume that the district court could properly hear the cross-claim.
Yes,
we hear your argument. Let's assume they could, and they lost it.
In that case, then, Your Honor is correct. There could not be, at least I don't read this, to allow an indemnification.
Right.
Yes, so, in that case.
So it's an idle argument to say that they acted in good or bad faith. There could be no indemnification.
In that situation, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think I've exceeded my time.
Good morning. I'm Dale Cooter for Independent Federal Savings Bank. On the issue of jurisdiction, it's the position of the bank that the court had original jurisdiction. When we got your order, I frankly had forgotten that this issue had been ruled on by the trial court, and so we asked the trial court's decision to be sent up here so you'd have the benefit of what she did on this issue. And even if I were wrong on that, the court clearly would have had supplemental jurisdiction. So either way it comes out, the court had jurisdiction to do what it did. On the issue of original jurisdiction, essentially in her ruling on the original motion to dismiss, she distinguished the cases that had been cited in support of the motion to dismiss. But as a practical matter, the Supreme Court took this issue up in Grable and Sons Metal Products versus DeRue Engineering, and basically under that, it doesn't matter that the counts were brought as state law counts. What matters is whether or not within the state law counts, there, in order to adjudicate the state law counts, the court has to determine an important federal interest. Now, in this particular case, the contract not only does the regulation specifically state how this whole issue is to be treated from the standpoint of federal law, but the contract itself incorporates the regulation. It makes reference to the fact that they're seeking this, advance of fees pursuant to the regulation. And once the regulation and the contract's issued pursuant to the terms of the regulation, because the regulation says there have to be contracts, it clearly is a substantial federal issue. And, of course, the reason for that is this is a federally insured institution, and it seems to me that Judge Williams' comment is to the point. The purpose isn't to protect directors. The purpose is to protect the bank from the improvident grant of regulation. So unless the court has further questions on jurisdiction, I just want to talk about the merits in the following way. And by the way, even if the court would have had supplemental jurisdiction as opposed to original jurisdiction, the court still would have jurisdiction. I don't see how that takes us anywhere. We did look at, after we got this court's order last week, what a court has to do to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, and it's pretty clear from the court's order on the cross-claim, and frankly from all of her orders, that she was exercising discretion to hear it anyway. She thought she had it, and I think she did. Now, the statutory scheme, it seems to me, is pretty simple. And the elements of the cross-claim are themselves pretty simple. That is, that the only time a director in this circumstance, standing in the shoes of these particular director defendants, would be entitled to indemnification, to include the payment of attorney's fees, would be if they won the case on the merits. Now, they clearly...
All right.
That's clearly an incomplete statement.
Right.
I'm sorry?
That's clearly an incomplete statement of the entitlement. Under subsection 2, there is another scenario.
Judge Williams, I agree with you. But all I'm saying is that these directors are not entitled to mandatory anything because there's no finding. They didn't win on the merits.
So on to permissive.
That's right. Now, permissive, in my common view of things, is just that. It is permissive. It is not mandatory. And what the reg says is that when you have a situation where the matter is determined so as not to require mandatory jurisdiction, then in some circumstances, the board can grant permissive indemnification. Now, those circumstances are pretty limited, actually, by way of this regulation. And in order to grant permissive regulation in this circumstance, under the last section of sub 2, the board would have to make an explicit finding that the activities of these directors were taken in good faith at the time that they did whatever they did.
The director's claim is that they're entitled to that decision, right? Then one way or the other, if it were against them, presumably it could be reviewed under, I would assume, a highly deferential standard. But their claim is essentially that they're entitled to a disinterested group of board members who would make such a decision.
Or in this circumstance, they would call any of the new directors interested.
They would, yeah,
which can't
really
be right. I mean, because that way there'd never be a board to make a decision one way or another.
No, but the question Judge Williams is raising, is there some obligation other than to say we didn't decide in your favor? It's permissive and we can sit on our hands and do nothing.
The answer is there is no such obligation in that regulation. The regulation, remember now, permissive indemnification is the exception, not the rule. There is no obligation of the board to make a finding of bad faith, which essentially is the argument, in order to exercise its business judgment not to give them the benefit of good faith.
Well, if you co-join the regulation with the contract, don't you have something more than what you're suggesting?
I don't think so, sir. That would be like saying that in order to enforce a contract, let's just deal with it as a simple contract case. I'm a plaintiff. I file a contract. I say, here are the terms of the contract. It's clear. In this case, the reg is pretty clear in my view. And in order to get a judgment on the contract, I would have to come in and make an affirmative showing, subjectively, of my good faith to enforce a contract. That has never been the law.
Well, the law, we're not talking about the law, we're talking about what the contract requires. Under the regulation, I hereby agree that I will repay the bank any amount so paid on my behalf by the bank if it is later determined that I'm not entitled to indemnification.
And it was later determined by an effective board resolution. The only difference...
Can a determination be whimsical in bad faith?
Well, whimsical...
Bad
let
faith?
Me say,
bad faith?
Let
bad
say,
faith.
Could a determination be in bad faith so as to vitiate that determination? I suppose hypothetically it could. The problem is, of course, that's not this case. And the problem is that the determination of the board on this whole issue of permissive indemnification, it seems to me, would be entitled to the protection of the business judgment rule. I mean, I don't want to get too technical. To the benefit of the business judgment rule, and any review of that determination by a court, whether it be the district court or whether it be this court, would have to be highly differential to the determination of the board itself in its business judgment. Now, Judge Edwards, if you take it in terms of the facts of this case, then of course what happens is the argument is that when we wanted the return of these advanced fees, we are in bad faith because the board should have found that these directors acted in good faith. How do you square that as a practical matter with the court's opinion on preliminary injunction, the district court's opinion? It is scathing as to these director defendants. Now, it's not a final judgment in the entitled to res judicata or collateral estoppel of fact, but it's pretty clear that these director defendants, when they say, well, we were acting in good faith and you had to make a finding that we were acting in bad faith, it seems to me, first of all, that's not what the reg says, but it seems to me in the context of this case is what would happen. The board, all that would have happened, I suppose, is that the resolution by the board would have said in this factual circumstance, we decline to exercise our discretion to give you, to let you keep the money because we don't believe your activities were in good faith. That phrase, we don't believe your activities were in good faith, would be, it's argued that that phrase itself is necessary, argued by the other side, is necessary in the board resolution. And the law imposes no such regulation, no such requirement on the wording of that board resolution. And the board resolution, nor does it require in the exercise of its business power as a board of directors to include a phrase saying, and we are not acting in bad faith. It simply ignores, it seems to me, the normal way in which a board of directors functions, and especially so when we're talking about the permissive spending of the bank's money. I see that my
let me ask you some questions on apportionment, assuming you're right in your preceding arguments. What's the standard of review on the district court's judgment with respect to apportionment?
It hasn't been appealed. The easy answer is the district court made an apportionment argument that these three as opposed to the entire six.
Now, what's the standard of review?
I suspect it's a mix. It's a question. I think it's a clearly erroneous standard of review.
Well, let me try and figure out from you what you think she did, because I can't figure it out. The district court said there's no joint liability. They're severably liable. The district court precedes the discussion by firmly rejecting the bank's position.
Yes, I was disappointed.
Yes,
in the firmness of that rejection.
You're walking on very soft ground as she then goes into what I was waiting for analytically, that is several liability. She repeats the contract, which says you're only responsible for your fair share. And then she says the three who did not lose, their fair share was zero. And I said, I must have missed some sentences.
No.
How do you get to zero? Where's the district court's analysis of how their fair share of the $600,000, which was advanced on behalf of six people, they were in the lawsuit, they were defended, so fees were spent on their behalf to defend them and get them out of the lawsuit. How does a district court reach the conclusion that their fair share was zero?
I can answer that question, having lived through these years of litigation.
Point to the finding.
All right. The court, you may or may not be aware that there was a third-party claim filed by the director defendants, the three that we have, seeking indemnification for the others. I don't think that is in your, I don't think it's in your appendix, what she did with that. But I can tell you that what she did with that is she said no, because fair share means just what it says, that which is fair. There was a serious factual distinction between the other director, and that she dismissed that third party claim, and there's been no appeal of that. And it dealt with this very issue, Judge Edwards, that you're talking about now. There was no appeal of that, and so I'm not even sure that that is before you.
Oh, it's absolutely before us. There's an apportionment made. They have clearly kept alive the question as to how did we get charged one-third of the total when there are three other people who benefited from the $600,000.
All right.
That is absolutely before us. That's a fight between whether the bank pays or these people pay.
And then let me take it a step further. I can tell you that I understand the logic of what she did.
Where are the findings? Come on, I want to narrow this down because we're out of time. Let's assume abuse of discretion is the standard of review, which I think based on the case law that we looked for and found, if you're going to exercise discretion, normally you have to explain what you did. I don't find any explanation whatsoever. So when I'm looking at this as a judge on the record, and I'm trying to understand, and I'm reading the sentences, several liability, everyone benefited from this payment. The three people who dropped out got counsel, so money was spent on their behalf for counsel support, and then the district court finds their contribution was zero. But there's no explanation as to how you reach that conclusion. I don't get it. Now, let me tell you one other thing, just so you understand what I'm reaching for and trying to figure out. You claimed in one of your papers below that the fees would not have been different if only three defendants had been sued. There are two things. We could find nothing in the record to support that, and the district court did not rest on that.
Nor do I rest on that.
Okay, so that's out of the case. If you don't rest on that, then I don't have the faintest idea how you can make the argument that an amount advanced for six, three of whom was successfully defended, equals zero contribution to those three.
With respect, the contract says that they will reimburse their fair share.
Right.
The issue is, what is their fair share?
All six signed that agreement.
That, with respect, sir, that doesn't necessarily follow.
Wait. What do you mean it doesn't follow? It's what happened.
All six signed that agreement.
They would be required to repay a fair share if, and the if had to do with whether you win or lose. The three clearly didn't lose, so they didn't have to repay anything. But that has nothing to do with what was their fair share of the money that was advanced on their behalf at the outset.
The problem I'm having with the court's logic, Judge Edwards, is that you're equating fair share with pro rata share. Those are not the same.
Not at all. I'm not. I'm asking, where's the district court's explanation as to how she figured out what the fair share was when we know that all six benefited from some portion of the $600,000.
My recollection of and I'd have to go back and reread this particular order, because I've read so many orders from Judge Collier now in this case that they run together. My recollection is that she reasoned that the three who we did not seek reimbursement from were passive. The wrongdoing that she found were orchestrated by these three defendants. It's unclear. I mean, I'll just tell you, it's unclear that the others even knew that this had happened. It all happened right there around the time of this shareholders meeting. And so there is a distinction in terms of the payment of the fees, I suggest to you, as a matter of fairness between the six and the three. Because the contract says my fair share, and because three were actively engaged in affirmative wrongdoing, and the other three didn't even know, it looks like, then fairness would dictate these three, as opposed
I understand that. The three who prevailed under the contract should not have to repay. That's right.
Nope.
I will repay the bank any amount so paid on my behalf. The money was paid on their behalf. It's a contract. They acknowledge it by contract if it's later determined that I'm not entitled to indemnification. Well, that certainly wasn't the finding with respect to the three, so they don't have to repay anything. Okay, they're out.
Of course, the court made no findings as to the three because we didn't seek reimbursement from the other three. And the reason that we didn't is they were passive. They literally did not know what had happened.
It was later determined that I'm not entitled. It was never determined that they were not entitled. Okay, so they're out of it.
I don't know how to say it any clearer than I said it, Judge. It seems to me that if you have a situation.
You have $600,000 paid for six people, $200,000 if you did straight proportion, which I agree is not the way you'd measure it. They're all benefiting from that pool of money. It's advance for attorney's fees. It's an advance for attorney's fees. They all benefited from that advance. The agreement was you only have to pay your fair share of that advance if it's later determined that you were not entitled to the indemnification. The key is your fair share.
Absolutely. Okay. The key is your fair share. And as I read that language in common English, it means that which is fair. It does not mean a pro rata 161616. And that's the logic of your question, Judge.
The fair share would be the reference back to the amount used on your behalf.
I can't.
Repay your fair share.
I can.
Well, let me tell you something. The cases that we could find with respect to related matters require the district court to give an explanation as to how it reached the sum of zero. Because whether you agree with me or not, I don't understand it. I don't get it. And normally we require the district court to explain it. And there is no explanation.
For some reason, I believe that in the order, but I didn't look at that for purposes of today's appeal, in the order where she dismissed the claim, their claim, third party claim for indemnity, she did set forth her logic as to why she was doing what she was doing. Now, I don't know if that order is in this appendix or not.
Well, I have her opinion. I'm looking at it.
On that motion?
On the point, I don't know which one you're talking about. So there was
they filed a third-party claim to bring the other three in. The other three got other counsel. I don't remember who it was. And moved to dismiss that. And in that opinion, where the court dismissed the third-party claim, I do believe that she did explicate why she was dismissing the passive three as opposed to the active.
Is there a brief somewhere in the argument? It was an issue raised before us. Did you point that out? I don't recall it. If you did, fine. I'll go back and look. I don't remember. That's your responsibility, not mine.
I'm not suggesting that you have the responsibility.
No, but what counsel is saying, we have a standard of review. It's probably abuse of discretion here.
Right.
Either it's on the face of the district court's decision, and I can't find it, or you guide us somewhere, and I don't remember you guiding us anywhere. So my question to you, with bottom line, is how has the district court's discretion not been abused when the district court gives no explanation as to how you reach zero as the three and force the others to take on the burden of money that was given in part for the three who've been dismissed?
The only thing I can do is point you to her decision on that third-party claim. But because there was no affirmative appeal of the decision on the third-party claim, I frankly am surprised at this inquiry. But having said that, it's either there or it isn't. I certainly agree with you that her order as to the joint and the several nature, as opposed to joint and several nature, doesn't go into that in any detail. I agree with that. But I commend you to look at the order on the third-party claim, because I'm virtually certain that she did say why she did what she did, and it would be in that order. All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Cook, you actually had no time left. We'll give you 1 minute.
I do have a question. I have to confess that my understanding of the briefs was the same as Mr. Cooter's, namely that no issue was raised as to the apportionment. So could you show me precisely where in your opening brief such an issue is raised?
We raised, let me see here. We pointed out on page, well, I'll do it this way.
I mean, let me just, your main argument heading is appellee has failed to meet its summary judgment burden, and then it goes on to talk about the obligations of the bank under the regulation and the contract, but it doesn't seem to quarrel visibly to me with the allocation made by the judge.
On pages 20 and 21, Your Honor, I think it says here, furthermore, nothing in the regulation imposes upon IFSB a duty to establish that IFSB acted in good faith in demanding reimbursement only from Jordan, Wilmot, and Batiste, and not from the other three director defendants that were voluntarily dismissed from the vendor litigation. Part of our concern we raised in the opening brief was that the obligation to act in good faith was
evidence that it was not in good faith was that these other three directors did not have any assessment made against them by IFSB, that the cases against them were voluntarily dismissed by IFSB against them. And so from our perspective, there is a disparate treatment that in that regard. Now, whether or not Judge Edwards' argument that
we... the place where you've directed us, that the leading sentence for the paragraph is addressed itself to the trial court's rejection of the argument that the Bender-controlled IFSB board has an obligation to act in good faith. And you say that's inconsistent with this and that. I mean, if this is a question about the apportionment, it's very obscure to me.
What Judge Williams is asking, and you have to, I mean, you may love my questioning, but you'd better point us to something. The district court has a long...
Enjoy your question, Jeff.
Yeah, right. District court has a long section on joint and several liability, which I read with great care and, quite frankly, intuitively makes no sense to me because it's not supported. Maybe it can be supported under law with some reasoning, but it's not. Judge Williams is saying, okay, fine, I heard my colleague's questions. He's saying to you, counsel, this is your shot. Before I go to conference, where did you raise that argument?
Right.
I mean, I saw places where it occurred to me that that's what you were saying, but you better talk to all three of us and show where in fact that argument has been raised with some precision, because if it's not, then it's not raised. Because it leaps out in the opinion. It's a huge section.
Right. We talk about on page 21 that the bank can only advance fees to its directors and officers pursuant to specific requirements of the regulation, and that the agreement did not provide any basis for disparate treatment between the six directors.
Where do you talk about disparity?
That's on page 21, Your Honor, of the opening brief.
My eye is not lighting on the phrase disparate treatment.
No. Those are my words. I said the part of what we're talking about is in here is disparate treatment.
Well, I understand. That's the question that's now under discussion. But I still am seeking for words in the brief that point me to that as an issue.
Where do you argue in the brief that the district court's findings and conclusions under the joint and several liability section have to be reversed?
Let's see, Your Honor. I just had it when I was in the order that the court issued on the. Let me see.
You know, you don't have to come up with something.
No, I'm not trying to come up with something. I'm just trying to be consistent, I hope.
Sees lots. I mean, it was a natural question given the nature of the district court opinion, but sometimes counsel don't raise issues.
And that's true, Your Honor.
The only thing that leaps out is you say, at one point, why do we pay and they don't?
Right, Your Honor.
That's not taking precise issue with
the order of the court,
right?
In the
review,
right? In the argument that we made about there being this disparate treatment, that these three directors were treated differently than the others, and that evidenced a lack of good faith on the part of the board, because again, this was a very contentious struggle between the two sides, and once Mr. Bender's forces prevailed,
so this is just, I mean, insofar as we can find it here at all. It is a reason for impugning the good faith of the board, and it assumes that we've already reached your conclusion that the board had a duty to act under the permissive provisions of the regulation.
Well, I think
otherwise,
it had a duty to act under the permissive portion of the regulation, but it also had a duty to act in good faith pursuant to the
the common law contract law in the District of Columbia. As I pointed out in the Allworth decision.
I understand that argument. I understand. But we only get to it once we've found that you have been deprived of a decision of not merely the outcome, but a decision-making process that you claim the board was obliged to enter into.
I don't know if I agree that, Your Honor, you only get to it then, because I do think that the contract, notwithstanding the regulation, provides
whether
a basis.
Whether it comes out of the contract or whatever, it's this duty
correct,
for the board to do it, to act.
I agree, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.